handful of raisins from a tin on the draining board. "What will you do without me?" she asked as she threw a couple onto the kitchen floor. The bird gobbled them up and looked to her for more. "Outside now, my friend," she said, scattering the rest of the raisins onto the doorstep. She took her tea back into the sitting room, making precarious progress with a single stick, and gingerly lowered herself into her chair. The room was full of pretty things, weird and wonderful baubles and ornaments. Eulalia had been a magpie all her life, surrounding herself with sparkle and glister, twinkle and velvet, the magical and the macabre. But now the time had come to let them go. These were her treasures, and she would decide their fate. She couldn't take them with her, but neither could she bear the thought of her precious things being picked over by a white van driver called Dave. House clearances, no job too big or too small. Besides, some of the things could get her into trouble. Some of the things weren't exactly legal. Well, not here, anyway. There were skeletons in her cupboards. Truly. By the time she had filled her tartan shopping trolley with the chosen objects, it was almost midday. Her ratchety limbs, lubricated by activity, moved more freely now as she headed towards the public gardens by the park. She would give her things away. She would leave them where others would find them, as many things as she had been able to drag in her trolley. And as for the rest, no one would have them. It was a school day, and the park and gardens were deserted, save for a couple of dog walkers and a poor unfortunate soul still asleep in the bandstand. Eulalia was unobserved, as she placed four snow globes, a rabbit's skull, and a gold pocket watch on the little wall that encircled the ornamental fountain. Further into the park, two silver church candlesticks, a stuffed weasel, and a set of gold-plated dentures were secreted in the niches of the war memorial statue. A mummified pig's penis and the Ormolu music box from Paris were left on the steps by the pond, and the China bride doll with empty eye sockets on the seat of one of the children's swings. Back in the gardens, the crystal ball wallowed in a stone bird bath, and the bowler hat with a cockade of crow's feathers was perched on top of the sundial. The ebony cursing bowl was placed at the foot of a sycamore tree whose leaves were a molten kaleidoscope of scarlet, orange, and yellow. And so she continued, until, almost emptied, the trolley bounced along behind her on skittish wheels. She sat down on the wooden bench facing the park and breathed a sigh of contentment. A job well done. Almost. The final item on the wooden slats beside her was a bone china cup and saucer, painted with gold and violets. It rattled in the aftershock of an explosion two streets away, that killed a postman and seriously injured a passer-by. A thick pall of smoke smudged a dark column into the afternoon sky. And Eulalia smiled as she remembered that she had left the gas on.
"Put the gas on under the kettle, tea to the teapot, milk to the jug." Back in the kitchen, Laura smiled as Sunshine talked herself through the tea-making as she always did with any task that required concentration. There was a knock at the back door, and without waiting for a reply, Freddy came in. Laura had spoken to him the night before to let him know that his job was still there if he wanted it, and to invite him for tea in the kitchen rather than drinking it alone in the garden as he usually did. He had been away since the funeral. And when he had left, the situation at Padua had still been uncertain. She had surprised herself by issuing the invitation, but reasoned that the more often she came into contact with him, the less flustered she might be when she did, because she couldn't help but find him rather increasingly attractive.
"Two sugars, please," he said, winking at Sunshine, who blushed deeply and found something fascinating to look at on the teaspoon she was holding.
Laura knew how she felt.
There was something intriguing about this laconic man who tended the garden with such care and did odd jobs around the place with quiet efficiency. Laura had learned scarcely anything about his life away from Padua. He gave so little away, and she hadn't yet found the courage to ask. But she was building up to it, she promised herself. The only information he seemed to require was what needed doing, and if there were any biscuits. "Freddy, this is Sunshine, my new friend and assistant. Sunshine, this is Freddy." Sunshine tore her gaze away from the teaspoon and tried to look Freddy in the eye.
"Hi, Sunshine. How's it going?"
"How's what going? I'm 19 and I'm Down syndrome."
Freddy smiled.
"I'm 35 3/4 and I'm a Capricorn."
Sunshine placed a cup of tea in front of Freddy and then the milk jug and sugar bowl. Then a teaspoon and a plate of biscuits. And then a fork, a bottle of washing-up liquid, a packet of cornflakes and an egg whisk, and a box of matches. Freddy's slow smile split his handsome face, revealing a perfect set of white teeth. The smile burgeoned into a deep, throaty laugh. Whatever Sunshine's test was, he had passed it. She sat down next to him.
"Saint Anthony has left all the lost things to Laura, and we have to get them back at the right people, except the cup and saucer."
"Is that right?"
"Yes, it is. Shall I show you?"
"Not today. I'll finish my tea and washing up liquid first, and then there's a job I have to go to. But next time I'm here, it's a date."
Sunshine almost smiled. Laura was beginning to feel a little superfluous. "Anthony was certainly a very good man, Sunshine, but strictly speaking, he wasn't a saint." Freddy drained his cup.
"Well, now, he could have been. Have you ever heard of Saint Anthony of Padua, the patron saint of lost things?"
Laura shook her head.
"I kid you not, it's true. 5 years at Sunday school,"
he added by way of explanation. Sunshine smiled triumphantly. Now she had two friends. Chapter 19. Laura was throwing away her old life. It was going to be a messy business. She tipped a box full of junk into the bin and slammed the lid shut, blowing a puff of dust and dirt into her face in the process. She had been sorting through the last of the things she had brought with her from the flat, many of which hadn't been unpacked since she had moved from the house she had shared with Vince. If she hadn't needed them in the last 6 or so years, she reasoned, she wasn't likely to need them now. The local charity shop might have been glad of some of her junk, but that would involve a trip into town, which Laura wasn't keen to make. "I'm too busy for that at the moment," she convinced herself. Before the ink could dry on her words of excuse, they were smudged with guilt as she remembered Anthony's letter.
"There is a world outside of Padua, and it is well worth a visit now and then."
"Another day," she promised herself. She wiped the grime from her face with her hands, and then wiped her hands on her jeans. God, she was filthy. Time for a shower.
"Hello? Do you work here?"
The question came from a leggy blonde who appeared down the path at the side of the house in skin-tight jeans and pale pink suede loafers, which boasted telltale Gucci horsebit trims and matched perfectly with her cashmere sweater. Laura's dumbfounded expression clearly caused the young woman to assume that she was either foreign, simple, or deaf. She tried again, speaking very slowly and a little too loudly.
"I'm looking for Freddo, the groundsman."
Thankfully, at that moment, the man himself appeared, sauntering down the garden carrying a wooden crate of freshly dug potatoes that he set down at Laura's feet.
"Darling Freddo!"
The young woman flung her arms around his neck and kissed him enthusiastically on the lips. Freddy gently untangled himself and took her hand.
"Felicity, what in God's name are you doing here?"
"I've come to take my darling boyfriend out to lunch."
Freddy grinned. He looked a little uncomfortable.
Felicity, this is Laura.
Laura, this is Felicity.
So I gather, Laura nodded, but didn't offer her hand, which was just as well, because Felicity wasn't in the habit of shaking hands with the help. The happy couple trotted off arm in arm, and Laura took the potatoes into the kitchen and banged the crate down on the table.
Sodding cheek, she fumed. Do I look like I work here?
Catching sight of herself in the hall mirror, Laura was forced to reconsider. With her unkempt hair scragged back under a spotted bandana, grime-streaked face and baggy shapeless sweatshirt, she looked like a modern-day scullery maid.
Bugger!
She stomped upstairs and had a long hot shower, but afterwards, as she sat on her bed swathed in a towel, it was clear that the water had only succeeded in washing away the dirt and not her anger. She was jealous. She was mortified to admit it, but she was. The sight of that wretched woman kissing Freddy had thoroughly annoyed her. Laura raised her eyebrows at her own reflection in the dressing table mirror and smiled sheepishly.
I can go out to lunch if I like.
That was it. She would go out to lunch. Anthony had wanted her to go out, and so she would. Today, right now. The Moon Is Missing was a smart casual pub with black tie aspirations. Its proximity to St. Luke's meant it was popular for post-funeral pick-me-ups and pre-wedding loin girders. Laura ordered a whiskey and soda and herb-crumbed goujons of cod served with hand-cut wedges of King Edward's and a lightly frothed tartar sauce, and took a seat in one of the booths that lined the wall facing the bar. Her bravura had deserted her almost as soon as she had left the house, and what should have been a treat had become something to endure, like a visit to the dentist or a crawl through rush-hour traffic. Laura was glad she had arrived early enough to bag a booth, and that she had remembered to bring a book with her to hide behind, just in case anyone tried to talk to her. On her way here, it had suddenly and rather worryingly occurred to her that Freddy and the frisky Felicity might also be lunching in this particular pub, but much though the thought horrified her, she was too stubborn to turn back. And so, here she was, drinking in the middle of the day, which was unheard of, and pretending to read a book she wasn't really interested in, whilst waiting for a lunch that she didn't really want. All in order to prove a point to herself and not let Anthony down. And to think that she could have been at home cleaning the cooker. Even Laura couldn't help but crack a wry smile at her own ridiculousness. The pub was filling up, and just as the waitress brought her posh fish fingers and chips, the booth next to Laura's was occupied with a great deal of huffing and puffing and shedding of coats and shopping bags. As her new neighbours began reading aloud from the menu, Laura recognised the imperious alto of Marjorie Wadscallop, accompanied by the dithering descant of Winnie Cripp. Having decided upon and ordered two Poussin and Portobello potage, the pair chinked their glasses of gin and tonic and began discussing the production of Blythe Spirit currently in rehearsal by their amateur dramatics group. Of course, technically, I'm far too young to play Madame McCarthy, asserted Marjorie, but then the part does require an actor of extraordinary range and subtlety, so I suppose, considering the dramatis personae at Everard's disposal, I was the only real choice.
Yes, of course you were, dear, agreed Winnie, and Gillian's an absolute pro at costumes and makeup, so she'll have you looking old in no time.
Marjorie was unsure whether to be pleased about this or not.
Well, she absolutely looks like a pro with the amount of slaps she normally wears, she replied tetchily.
Naughty,
giggled Winnie, and then fell guiltily silent as the waitress arrived with their chicken and mushroom soups, accompanied by an assortment of artisan bread rolls. There was a brief hiatus while they salted their soups and buttered their bread.
I'm a bit nervous about playing Edith, Winnie then confessed. It's the biggest part I've had so far, and there's an awful lot of lines to remember, as well as that carrying of drinks and walking on and off.
You mean stage business and blocking, Winnie. It's so important to use the correct terminology.
Marjorie took a large bite from her granary roll and chewed on it thoughtfully before adding,
I shouldn't worry too much, dear. After all, Edith is only a housemaid, so you won't be required to do very much real acting.
Laura had finished her lunch and asked for the bill. Just as she was gathering her things to leave, the mention of a familiar name caught her attention.
I'm sure Geoffrey will be a perfectly serviceable Charles Condamine, but in his younger days, Anthony Perdue would have been ideal for the role. Tall, dark, handsome, and so very charming.
Marjorie's voice had taken on an almost wistful tone.
And he was a writer in real life, too, added Winnie.
Marjorie's tongue sought to dislodge a grain from her roll, which had become caught under her dental plate. Having succeeded, she continued,
It does seem rather odd that he left everything to that rather prickly housekeeper of his, Laura.
It's a funny business, all right.
Winnie loved a side order of scurrilous gossip with her lunch.
I shouldn't wonder if there wasn't a bit of funny business going on there, she added knowingly, delighted at her double entendre.
Marjorie drained the last of her gin and tonic and signalled to the waitress to bring her another one.
Well, I expect she did a little more for him than just the dusting and hoovering.
Laura had intended to try and sneak past them without being seen, but now she turned and faced them with a brazen smile.
Fellatio, she announced, every Friday.
And without another word, she swept out. Winnie turned to Marjorie with a puzzled expression.
What's that when it's at home?
Italian, said Marjorie, dabbing at her mouth with a napkin. I had it in a restaurant once.
Chapter 20 Sunshine set the needle onto the spinning licorice disc and was rewarded with the mellifluous tones of Etta James, hot and rich like smoked paprika. In the kitchen, Freddy was sitting at the table, and Laura was making sandwiches for lunch.
She's got great taste.
Freddy tipped his head in the direction of the music. Laura smiled.
She's choosing the music for when we scatter Anthony's ashes. She says it's like the film, where the dog gets a bone and the clocks stop because St. Anthony's dead. But he'll be together forever with Therese. But she calls her the Lady of the Flowers, and your guess is as good as mine.
She sliced cucumber into translucent slices and drained a tin of salmon. She wants to make a speech as well, although I'm not sure we'll make head or tail of it.
I'm sure we'll make it out just fine.
Freddy spun a teaspoon that was idling on the table.
She just has her own way of saying stuff, that's all. She knows the words that we all use, but I suppose she just likes hers better.
Laura licked a smudge of butter from her finger. She wasn't used to having actual conversations with Freddy. His way of saying stuff was usually a combination of nods, shrugs, and grunts. But Sunshine wasn't having any of that. With her solemn eyes and soft, fluty voice, she coaxed the words from him like a snake charmer.
But isn't she just making life harder? Setting herself further apart?
Laura's voice trailed off along with her train of thought, stymied by political correctness. Freddy weighed her words carefully and without judgment.
Further apart from normal people, you mean?
It was Laura's turn to shrug. She didn't really know what she meant. She knew that Sunshine had made few friends at school and had been mercilessly taunted by the feral teenagers who hung around in the local park drinking cheap cider, vandalizing the swings, and having sex. Were they normal? And if they were, why should Sunshine want to be like them? Freddy balanced the neck of the teaspoon on the tip of his index finger. Laura went back to the sandwiches and began cutting them viciously into triangles. Now he would think she was a a what? Bigot? Idiot? Maybe she was. The more she saw of Freddy, the more it mattered what he thought of her. Laura's idea of inviting Freddy to take his breaks in the kitchen in order to facilitate a more relaxed relationship between them could not yet be deemed a success. But the time they spent together was the part of the day she looked forward to most. Freddy placed the teaspoon carefully down in front of him and leaned back in his chair, rocking the two front legs off the floor. She fought the urge to tell him to sit properly at the table.
I think it's a sort of camouflage.
He rocked back onto four legs.
The way she speaks. It's like a Jackson Pollock. There's so many specks and splashes of paint that if one of them happens to be a mistake, no one can tell. If Sunshine does get a word wrong, we'll never know.
He shook his head, smiling to himself.
It's genius.
At that moment, the genius came into the kitchen looking for her lunch. Laura was still thinking about what Freddy had said. A gardener using the art of Jackson Pollock as a linguistic metaphor was a little unexpected, and another intriguing insight into the kind of man he really was. It made Laura both eager and determined to find out more.
By the way, said Freddy to Laura, the film, it's four weddings and a funeral.
Sunshine grinned and sat down next to her newest friend. After lunch, they all went through to the study. Sunshine was desperate to show Freddy Anthony's museum of missing things, and Laura was toying with the idea of asking if he had any bright ideas about returning them to their rightful owners. Each time she came into the study, it seemed to Laura that the room was filling up. Less space, more things. And she felt smaller, shrinking, sinking. The shelves seemed to groan, threatening collapse, and the drawers creak, dovetails about to fly open and burst. She feared she would be buried under an avalanche of lost property. For Sunshine, it was a treasure trove. She stroked and held and hugged the things, talking softly to herself, or perhaps to the things themselves, and reading their labels with obvious enchantment. Freddy was appropriately astonished.
"Who'd have thought it?" he whispered, peering at his surroundings. "So that's why he always carried his bag."
The frail October sunlight struggled to permeate the trellis of flowers and leaves on the lace panels, and the room was dark and stained with shadows. He drew back the lace, shooting a meteorite shower of shimmering dust motes spinning across the room.
"Let's throw a bit of light over things, shall we?"
Sunshine showed him round, like a curator proudly sharing a collection of fine art. She showed him buttons and rings, gloves, teddy bears, a glass eye, items of jewellery, a jigsaw puzzle piece, keys, coins, plastic toys, tweezers, four sets of dentures, and a doll's head. And these were the contents of only one drawer. The cream cup and saucer, painted with violets, was still on the table. Sunshine picked it up and handed it to Freddy.
It's pretty, isn't it? The lady doesn't want it back to her, so Laura's going to keep it for the lovely cup of tea.
Laura was about to contradict her, but Sunshine's face was set with such absolute certainty that the words died in Laura's mouth.
That'll be yours, then.
As Laura took the cup and saucer from him, his fingers brushed against her hand, and he held her gaze for just a moment before turning away and sitting down in Anthony's chair.
"And you're to try and get all the rest of this," he said, sweeping his arms around the room, "back to wherever it is that it belongs."
His equable tone gave no quarter to the enormity of the task. "That's the idea," Laura replied. Sunshine was distracted by an object that had fallen out of the drawer she had opened. She picked it up from the floor, but immediately dropped it again, howling in pain.
Lady's glove, navy blue leather, right hand. Found on the grass verge at the foot of Cowbridge, 23rd of December. It was bitter. Too cold for snow. Rose looked up at the black sky, pierced with a tracery of stars and a sharp sickle moon. She had been walking briskly for 20 minutes, but her feet were numb and her fingers frozen. Too sad for tears. She was almost there now. Thankfully there had been no passing cars, no one to distract or intervene. Too late to think. Here now, this was the place. Over the bridge and then just the shallow, grassy bank. She took off one glove and pulled the photograph from her pocket. She kissed the face of the little girl who smiled back at her. Too dark to see, but she knew she was there. "Mummy loves you." Down the grassy slope, her gloveless hand clutched at razor-frozen grass. At the bottom, shale underfoot. "Mummy loves you," she whispered again, as the distant lights pricked the darkness, and the rails began to hum. Too hard to live.
"Too hard to live? The lady died." Sunshine was shaking as she tried to explain.
Freddy pulled her close and squeezed her tight.
"I think that what you need is the lovely cup of tea."
He made it, under Sunshine's strict supervision. Two cups of tea and a jammy dodger later, she tried to tell them a little more.
"She loved her little girl, but the lady was very sad," was the best that she could do.
Laura was strangely unsettled. "Sunshine, maybe it would be better if you didn't go into the study any more."
"Why?"
Laura hesitated. Part of her didn't want Sunshine becoming too involved. She knew it was selfish, but she was desperate to find a way to make Anthony and maybe even her parents proud of her. Posthumously, of course. It was her chance to finally do something right, and she didn't want any distractions. "In case there are other things in here that upset you." Sunshine shook her head determinedly.
"I'm okay now."
Laura looked unconvinced, but Sunshine had a point to make.
"If you never get sadness, how do you know what happy is like?" she asked. "And by the way, everybody dies."
"I think she has you in checkmate there," Freddy murmured.
Laura conceded defeat with a reluctant smile.
"But," continued Freddy, "I may have the very thing to cheer you up. I have a plan."
Chapter 21 Sunshine stood waiting by the sundial, a solemn figure in a pink duffel coat and silver sequined baseball boots. The dank October afternoon was already seeping away, the edges of an empty sky tinged with the rhubarb flush of a looming sunset. On Sunshine's signal, Freddy started the music and took his place next to Laura to walk down the aisle of flickering tea lights to where Sunshine was waiting to start the ceremony. Freddy was carrying Anthony's ashes in a plain wooden urn, and Laura held a fancy cardboard box full of real rose petal confetti and the photograph of Therese from the garden room. Laura fought the urge to giggle as she walked as slowly as she could to the inevitable accompaniment of Al Bowley. Sunshine had planned everything down to the last detail. The gramophone had been conveniently positioned so that Freddy could reach it by leaning in the window, and the confetti and rose-scented candles for the tea lights had been ordered especially. Sunshine had originally wanted to wait until the roses were in bloom again, but Laura couldn't bear the thought of Anthony's ashes languishing on a shelf for the next 9 months. She couldn't keep him from Therese any longer. The rose-scented candles and confetti had been a hard-won compromise. Freddy and Laura reached Sunshine just as Mr. Bowley was beginning his final verse, and she listened, really listened to the words for perhaps the first time. It could have been written for Anthony and Therese. Sunshine left a pause just long enough for it to be dramatic, before consulting the piece of paper she was clutching.
"Dreary beloved, we are gathered here in the sight of God, and in the fate of this complication,
to join together this man, Saint Anthony, she tapped the top of his urn, and this woman, the Lady of the Flowers, gesturing towards the photograph with an upturned palm. In Holy Macaroni, which is the Honourable Estate. Saint Anthony takes the Lady of the Flowers to be the lawful wedding wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better for worse, richer or poorer, to love and to perish, with death now you start. And it still rhymes, she added proudly to herself.
She paused again, long enough this time for it to be almost uncomfortable, but no doubt with the intention of underscoring the sanctity of the occasion.
Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, funky to punky, we know Major Tom's a monkey. We can be heroes just for today.
She leaned forward and addressed Freddy and Laura in a stage whisper. Now you throw the ashes, and you throw the confetti. And then, as an afterthought,
follow me.
They made an odd little procession filing round the rose garden, Sunshine leading them in and out of the desolate-looking bushes, whose summer finery had been reduced to a ragbag of sodden, yellowing leaves stubbornly clinging on. Freddy followed Sunshine, emptying the urn as delicately as he could, with Laura behind him, trying to avoid any backdraft as she scattered confetti on the wispy grey trail of Anthony's remains. The scattering of ashes had always sounded like such an ethereal act to Laura, but in reality, she reflected, it was more akin to emptying a vacuum cleaner bag. When the urn was finally empty, Sunshine consulted her piece of paper once again.
He was her north, her south, her east, her west, her working week and Sunday vest. She was his moon and stars and favourite song. They thought that love would last forever. They weren't wrong.
Freddy winked at her, smiling broadly.
And it still rhymes, he mouthed.
Sunshine wasn't to be distracted.
I now announce you husband and wife. Those whom God and Sunshine have joined together, let no man steal their thunder.
She nodded at Freddy, who scampered off in the direction of the gramophone.
And now it's time for the bride and groom's first dance.
As the dying sun stained the ice-blue sky crimson, and a blackbird's call echoed through the gathering dusk, warning of a prowling tabby, Etta James proclaimed, "At last." As the final note smouldered into the chilly air, Laura looked across at Freddy. He was gazing straight at her, and when her eyes met his, he smiled. Laura went to gather the tea lights, but Sunshine wasn't quite finished. She rattled her piece of paper and cleared her throat.
"I am the resurrection and the light, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And it's good night from me, and it's good night from him."
When Laura went up to bed that night, the room felt different somehow. Perhaps it was warmer, or maybe that was just the wine she had shared with Freddy and Sunshine to celebrate Therese and Anthony's reunion. The things on the dressing table were all in order, and the little blue clock had stopped at 11:55 as usual. She wound it up so that it could stop at the same time again tomorrow, drew the curtains, and turned to get into bed. There were petals of rose confetti on the bed covers.
Chapter 22. Eunice, 1987. Betty trotted along just ahead of them, surveying the park for undesirables. Every now and then she would turn to check that they were following her obediently, her velveteen face crumpled into a comical smile. She was named after the film star, to whom she bore an unnerving resemblance, but they had taken to calling her Baby Jane after one of her namesake's most memorable characters. Bomber had been freeze-framed by Douglas's death. He had held the little dog in his arms until long after his final breath had sighed the end, and his soft fur had grown cold and strange. Eunice had howled an eruption of pain, but Bomber sat rigid and dry-eyed, as an ash cloud of grief settled over him and choked his tears. The Douglas-shaped space in the office hurt every day. They were a man down and a doughnut too many. But Eunice kept going, on automatic pilot at first, but onwards nevertheless. Bomber crashed and burned. He drank away his pain, and then he slept away the drink. In the end, only one man could reach him. It was difficult to say who had fallen for Tom Cruise the hardest, Bomber or Eunice, as he swaggered from bike to bar to plane in his Ray-Bans. They had seen Top Gun 3 nights in a row when it had opened at the Odeon the previous year. 3 weeks after Douglas died, Eunice stormed Bomber's flat with her spare key and kicked his grieving arse out of bed. As he sat at the kitchen table, tears finally released and dripping down his face and into the mug of black coffee Eunice had made, she took his hand. "God, he loved flying with you, Bomber, but he'd have flown anyway without you. He'd have hated it, but he would have done it." The following day, Bomber came into the office sober, and the following week, Baby Jane arrived from Battersea Dog's Home, a bossy bundle of black and blonde velvet. Baby Jane didn't like doughnuts. The first time she was offered one, she sniffed at it disdainfully and turned away. It might as well have been a turd tartlet. Baby Jane liked Viennese whirls. For a stray, she had expensive tastes. As the diminutive pug nosed an empty crisp packet on the grass, Eunice looked up at Bomber and almost recognised him again. His grief was still smudged under his eyes and pinched into his cheeks, but his smile was limbering up, and his shoulders unfurling from their disconsolate stoop. She was never going to be a replacement, but she was already a distraction, and if Baby Jane had her way, which she usually did, Eunice had no doubt whatsoever that she would eventually prove to be a superstar in her own right. Back in the office, Eunice put the kettle on while Bomber went through the post. Baby Jane settled herself onto her cushion and rested her head on her front paws, gathering herself for the arduous task of eating her cake. When Eunice came through with the tea, Bomber was waving a slim volume of short stories in the air that had just arrived from a rival publisher. "Lost and Found by Anthony Perdue. I've heard of this. It's doing rather well. I wonder why old Bruce has sent it to me." Eunice picked up the accompanying compliment slip and read it. "To gloat," she answered. "Bomber," she read, "please accept a copy of this hugely successful collection with my compliments. You had your chance, old chap, and you blew it." Bomber shook his head. "No idea what he's talking about. If this Perdue fellow had sent it to us first, we'd have snapped it up. It's an excess of hairspray. It's addled his brains." Eunice picked up the book and flicked through the pages. The author's name and title together, like two flints, sparked a vague memory. A manuscript? Eunice racked her brain for the answer, but it was like bobbing for apples. Just when she thought she'd got it by the skin of her teeth, it slipped away. Baby Jane sighed theatrically. Her cake was en retard, and she was weak with hunger. Eunice laughed and ruffled the soft rolls of velvet on her head. "You are such a diva, young lady. You'll get fat, and then no more cakes for you. Just jogging round the park and the occasional stick of celery, if you're lucky." Baby Jane stared up at Eunice dolefully, her black button eyes framed by long, dark lashes. It worked every time. She got her cake. At last. Just as she was licking her lips in an optimistic search for remaining flecks of cream, the phone rang. Each pair of rings was followed by an imperious bark. Since her arrival, Baby Jane had quickly assumed a managerial position, and she ran a very tight kennel. Bomber answered. "Ma!" He listened for a moment. Eunice watched his face and knew immediately that this was not good news. Bomber was on his feet. "Do you want me to come over? I'll come now, if you like. But don't be daft, Ma. Of course it's no trouble." It would be about Godfrey. The lovely, kind, funny, gentlemanly Godfrey, whose dementia was casting him adrift. A once majestic galleon whose sails had worn thin and tattered, no longer able to steer its own course, but left to the mercy of every squall and storm. Last month he had managed to flood the house and set fire to it at the same time. He had started to run a bath and then forgot about it, going downstairs to dry his shirt, which he left on the hot plate of the Arga, before setting off for the village to buy a paper. By the time Grace had come in from the greenhouse, the water leaking through the kitchen ceiling had put out the fire started by the shirt. She hadn't known whether to laugh or cry, but she refused to accept that she needed help. He was her husband, and she loved him. She had promised, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. She couldn't bear to think of him in a home where the interior design included armchairs with built-in commodes. And yet, this time he had run away. Well, wandered off, more like. After an hour of frantically searching the village, Grace had come home to telephone the police. She was met at the gate by the local vicar, who, on his way to visit a parishioner, had found Godfrey walking in the middle of the road, with a broom held up against his shoulder like a rifle, and Grace's red beret stretched onto his head. He told the Reverend Adelstrop that he was returning to his regiment after a weekend pass. Bomber dropped the phone back into its cradle with a resigned sigh. "Do you want me to come with you, or stay here and hold the fort with Baby Jane?" Before he could answer, the buzzer went. Portia received the news of her father's latest escapade with horrible tranquillity. She refused to join Bomber and go and see her parents, let alone offer any kind of help or support. Bomber tried in vain to crack the surface of her callous composure. "This is serious, sis. Ma can't be expected to watch over him every minute of the day and night, and he's a danger to himself. And before long, God forbid, he may be to her as well." Portia inspected her scarlet fingernails. She'd just had them done, and she was quite pleased. She'd even tipped the girl a pound. "Well, what do you expect me to do about it? He belongs in a home." "He is in a home," Eunice hissed. "His home." "Oh, shut up, eunuch. It's none of your business." "Well, at least she gives a damn," snapped Bomber. Stung by Bomber's painful reprimand and secretly terrified by her father's illness, Portia responded in the only way she knew how to, with insults. "You heartless bastard! Of course I care about him. I'm just being honest. If he's dangerous, he needs to be locked up. At least I've got the guts to say it. You always were completely spineless, always sucking up to Ma and Pa, never once standing up to them, like me." Baby Jane could see that things were getting out of hand, and she wasn't having her friends spoken to in that manner. A low growl rumbled her displeasure. Portia sought out the source of the admonishment and found the feisty little pug preparing for battle. "Is that revolting-looking cushion pisser still here? I should have thought you'd have had enough when that other little monster finally died." Eunice glanced across to where Douglas's ashes sat safe in a box on Bomber's desk, and offered a silent apology. She was just wondering how to inflict appropriate and excruciating pain on this execrable woman, when she realized that Baby Jane had already decided. Leaving her cushion with the prowling menace of a lion who has just spotted a dithering gazelle, she fixed Portia with her fiercest stare, and turned up the volume until her whole body vibrated. Her lips curled back, revealing a small but businesslike set of teeth. Portia flapped her fingers ineffectually at her, but Baby Jane continued her advance, eyes fixed firmly on her prey, and growl now punctuated by dramatic snarls. "Shoo! Shoo! Sit down!" Baby Jane kept coming. Halfway across the floor, Portia capitulated with an undignified retreat and an unladylike barrage of expletives. Bomber began gathering his things. Eunice repeated her offer of help. I'll come with you if you want me to. He smiled gratefully but shook his head. No, no. I'll be fine. You stay here and look after Madam, he said, reaching down to fondle Baby Jane's ears while she gazed up at him adoringly.
At least we know now that it's true,
he added with a mischievous grin. What's that?
That Portia's a complete waste of hot air and high heels?
He shook his head and gently lifted a blonde paw in his hand.
Nobody puts Baby Jane in a corner.
Eunice hooted with laughter.
Get out of here, Patrick Swayze!
Chapter 23 Lost and Found by Anthony Perdew. I knew there was a copy somewhere in the house. Laura came into the kitchen triumphantly, waving a slim volume of short stories. Freddy looked up from the laptop he was hunched over on the kitchen table. He took the book from her and flicked through it.
Is it any good?
It depends what you mean by good. Laura sat down in the chair facing him. It did very well. Apparently, Anthony's publisher at the time was very happy. He was a peculiar little man, I seem to remember. He came to the house once or twice, used far too much hairspray.
Too much?
Freddy expostulated.
I should think that any is too much, unless you're Liberace or a ballroom dancer.
It's called male grooming, Laura smiled. But I wouldn't exactly call that your specialist subject, she added, looking at the unruly mop of dark curls that crept over the collar of his shirt and the stubble that shaded the contours of his face.
No need, he replied, winking at her. I'm naturally handsome.
He was, Laura silently agreed. Oh, God, she hoped it had been silent, but maybe she'd nodded. She could feel a telltale flush creeping up her neck. Bugger! Maybe he would just think it was her age. Double bugger! Maybe he would think it was her age, middle age, ready for big knickers, hot flushes and wincy at nighties, and she absolutely wasn't. In fact, she was going on a date.
But did you think it was any good?
Freddy was speaking. Sorry, miles away. What was that? Freddy waved the book at her.
Lost and found. What did you think?
Laura sighed and spread her hands on the table in front of her. I thought it was safe. It was beautifully written, as always, but the content had lost a little of his usual edge. It was a bit too happy ever after for me. It was almost as though if he wrote enough happy endings for other people, he'd get one for himself.
But it never came.
Laura smiled sadly. Until now. Fingers crossed.
Is that why he stopped writing?
Laura shook her head. No. He wrote several volumes of these short stories, based on the things he found, I now assume. At first they were optimistic tales, congenial and commercial. Bruce the Peculiar was delighted with them and, no doubt, the money they brought in. But over time the stories grew darker, the characters more ambivalent, flawed even. The happy endings gradually gave way to uncomfortable mysteries and unanswered questions. All this was before my time, of course. But when I eventually read them, I thought they were much better. And they were certainly more like his earlier work, crediting his readers with both imagination and intelligence. Anthony told me that Bruce had been furious. He just wanted more of the nice stories, literary lemonade. But Anthony had given him absinthe. Bruce refused to publish them, and that was that.
Didn't Anthony look for another publisher?
I don't know. By the time I started working for him, he seemed to be writing them more for himself than for anyone else. Eventually, he stopped giving me anything to type at all, apart from the odd letter. Laura picked up the book from the table and tenderly stroked its cover. She missed her old friend. Maybe that's what we should call the website. Lost and Found. The website had been Freddy's plan. At first, Laura had been unsure. For so many years, Anthony had resisted the intrusion of technology into his tranquil home. And to throw open the doors to the behemoth internet and all its goblin relatives so soon after his death somehow felt like a violation. But Freddy convinced her.
The only thing Anthony asked you not to change was the rose garden. He left the house to you because he knew that you would do the right thing. It's your home now, but it came with a covenant on its coattails, and Anthony trusted you to use whatever method you saw fit to get those things back to the people who are missing them.
The website would be a huge virtual lost property department where people could browse the things that Anthony had found and then reclaim items that belonged to them. They were still working on the details, including the name.
Lost and found. Too boring.
Sunshine had wandered in from the study looking for biscuits.
Shall I make the lovely cup of tea?
Freddy rubbed his hands together in exaggerated delight.
I thought you'd never ask. I'm as dry as James Bond's martini.
Sunshine filled the kettle and set it carefully on the hob.
How can the drink, which is wet because it's the drink, be dry?
That's a good question, kiddo,
said Freddy, thinking,
to which I'm buggered if I know the answer.
Laura saved him. How about the Kingdom of Lost Things? Sunshine wrinkled her nose in disapproval.
Saint Anthony kept all the lost things safe. He was the keeper, and now you are. We should call it the Keeper of Lost Things.
Brilliant, said Freddy.
Where's the biscuits? Said Sunshine.
Laura arrived back from the hairdresser's salon just as Freddy was leaving for the day.
You look different, he said almost accusingly. Have you got a new jumper?
She could quite cheerfully have kicked him. Her jumper was several years old and bore a generous sprinkle of pilling to prove it. But she had just spent the best part of 2 hours and 70 quid having her hair cut and coloured with what her stylist, Elise, had described as burnished copper lowlights. When she left the salon, tossing her glossy chestnut mane like a frisky show pony, she had felt like $1 million. Now, for some reason, she felt like she'd wasted her money. I've just had my hair done, she muttered through gritted teeth.
Oh, right, that must be it then,
he said, rummaging through his rucksack for his car keys. Finding them, he gave her a quick grin and headed for the door.
I'll be off then. See you tomorrow.
The door closed behind him, and Laura gave the bamboo umbrella stand a petulant kick, toppling its contents onto the floor. As she gathered up the scattered umbrellas and walking sticks, she told herself that her new hair wasn't for Freddy's benefit anyway, so it hardly mattered if he hadn't noticed. Upstairs, Laura admired the new black dress hanging on the front of the wardrobe. It was elegant and tasteful, but with a hint of sexy, exposing just the right ratio of legs to cleavage for a woman of her age, according to the saleswoman who had taken Laura's credit card. Laura thought it was a bit tight and bloody expensive. She would have to eat only a little and be sure not to spill anything down the front of it. Her date was called Graham. He was Vince's area manager, and she had bumped into him in the car park of The Moon Is Missing after her lunch there. She had met him many times at dealership Christmas dinners and numerous other social trials while she was married to Vince and he was married to Sandra. But now she wasn't, and neither, since quite recently, was he, and so he had asked her out. And fresh from meeting Felicity for the first time, she had thought, why not? And said yes. But now she wasn't so sure. As she wriggled into her dress and checked her hair yet again in the mirror, she was beginning to have doubts. According to Elise, whose salon chair doubled as a confessional for most of her clients, Laura was currently the favourite topic of conversation with the locals. In life, Anthony had attained the status of a minor celebrity on account of him being a published author. In death, therefore, it automatically followed that his affairs should remain squarely, if a little unfairly, in the public domain. His public's assessment of Laura apparently ranged from a conniving coffin chaser and a gold-digging tart to a faithful friend and deserved beneficiary and former traditional Irish dancing national champion. But I think Mrs. Morrissey might have got you muddled up with someone else there, Elise had to admit. Well, she's nearly 89 and only eats cabbage on a Thursday. Perhaps, thought Laura, she shouldn't be going out at all. People might think she was enjoying herself too soon after Anthony's death. In her new dress, with her new hair, it might look as if she were flaunting her inheritance, dancing on his grave before the earth had a chance to settle. Except, of course, he'd been burned and scattered, so technically there wasn't one. Well, it was too late now. She checked her watch. Graham would be almost there. He had always seemed like a nice man, a gentleman. "You'll be fine," she told herself. "It's only dinner." But by the time her taxi came, she wasn't feeling hungry at all. Graham was indeed a gentleman. He was waiting for her at the restaurant with a champagne cocktail and a slightly nervous smile. He took her coat, kissed her cheek, and told her that she looked lovely. As Laura sipped her drink, she began to relax. Well, as much as she could within the bondage of her dress. Perhaps it was going to be fine after all. The food was delicious, and Laura ate as much of it as she could manage to squeeze in, while Graham told her about his marriage breakup. The spark just fizzled out. They were still friends, but no longer lovers, and his new interest in Nordic walking. A total body version of walking with the aid of fiberglass poles. Laura resisted the urge to make a joke about him not looking old enough to need one walking stick, let alone two, but she had to concede that he did look fit. 46 next birthday, his torso was happily unencumbered by middle-aged spread, and his shoulders looked broad and hard-muscled beneath his well-pressed shirt. In the ladies' room, Laura congratulated herself as she reapplied her lipstick. "There's certainly nothing wrong with my date," she thought, "and he had beautiful table manners." She pressed her lips together and dropped her lipstick back into her bag. Graham insisted on accompanying Laura home in a taxi, and, relaxed by the wine and his easy company, Laura allowed her head to rest momentarily on his shoulder as she gave the driver directions to Padua. But she wasn't going to invite him in for coffee, the drink or the euphemism. She knew that she shouldn't let the gossip bother her, but she couldn't help it. And the tart epithet was the slap that smarted most. She'd only slept with three men in her entire life, and one of them was Vince, so he didn't count. She wasn't proud of it. In fact, she wished there'd been more. Perhaps if she'd tried more men out, she might have found the right one for her. But not on a first date. And Graham was a gentleman. He wouldn't expect it. 10 minutes later, a rather bewildered Graham was on his way home in the taxi. He hadn't even got past the front porch, let alone first base. Laura was in the bathroom gagging and gargling with antiseptic mouthwash. As she spat the stinging liquid into the basin, she glimpsed her still startled expression in the mirror. Teary mascara was already dribbling black scribbles down her cheeks, and her lipstick was smudged into a grotesque clown's mouth. She looked like a tart. She struggled furiously to escape from her dress, wrenching it over her head and viciously screwing it into a crumpled ball. In the kitchen, she flung it into the bin and yanked open the fridge door. The Prosecco tasted rank after the mouthwash, but Laura persevered and gulped it down. She took the bottle through to the garden room and lit the fire in the grate, knocking over her glass and breaking it in the process. "Shit, bugger, bollocks, stupid, sodding glass!" She addressed the sharp fragments which sparkled in the firelight. "Stay there, broken, then. See if I care." She wandered her way unsteadily back to the kitchen and found another glass. As she worked her way through the rest of the bottle, she stared into the flames, wondering what the hell she'd been playing at. Horribly drunk, and exhausted by sobbing and hiccuping, Laura fell asleep on the sofa, her tear-swollen face buried in her beautiful, newly burnished hair. Chapter 24. She slept for roughly 10 hours, but when she woke, she looked like she'd been sleeping rough for several weeks. The thudding inside her head was soon echoed by a sharp tapping on the glass of the French windows.